welcome to episode 19 of the Head Stuff podcast with Tara Flynn. I'm here with Connor Wilkins.
Hello.
Hello. And we have Tara on the podcast today. Tara is absolutely brilliant. Many of you will know her from being a loud and proud voice in the marriage equality campaign and the Repeal the Eighth campaign. She's also a comedian, improviser, an actress, author, and her new book, Giving Out Yards, is just out. I've read the book and it's actually excellent. I'm proud to report. So we just had the conversation with her, and I think it's really good. So we're going to go pretty much straight into it. Just to let you know that we're doing a live podcast, the first live episode of the Head Stuff podcast. It's on Tuesday, the 27th of October in Sober Lane, and we're going to be talking to Kevin McGahern, who's the host of Republic of Telly and a fine comedian, and Andrea Farrell, who is you might have seen her on the RTE New Comedy Awards and also a fine comedian. So that's going to be really fun. Please come down to it. You can find all the details on the website, headstuff.org.
There's beer, there's pizza, there's
yeah, beer and pizza deal. Is it €10 for a pint and a pizza? It's a full pizza and a really nice pizza.
No, it's a full pizza. It's a that's full pretty pizza. Good.
Yeah.
And a full pint.
And a full pint.
Sweet.
Yeah. There's also going to be all sorts of prizes and stuff, giveaways, that kind of thing. It's going to be a larf. So please come down to that. If you enjoy the podcast, come down and see the first live episode of it.
Now that you've used the word larf, I'm not going.
The word larf will not be used. I just didn't feel comfortable saying laugh for some reason. I don't know why.
I don't know, it's just such an annoying word.
It is a really annoying word, and I'm sorry. I apologise for having used it. I'm going to give the word laugh to Connor now so he can edit it over.
Oh, God. Okay, yeah, go on.
Laugh.
That's going to be seamless.
Perfect. We're recording today in the Westland Studios building,
yep.
Which is very nice. So thanks to the ADK Music Group for letting us in here. Also, you can buy the Headstuff t-shirts, which you can find on headstuff.org/shop. And we now have a Facebook group, which you should join. It's called the Headstuff Podcast. And it's a group for all you people who like the podcast. So just join that and you'll be seeing discussions and questions, and you can get feedback and anything like that. So this is the episode now. It's episode 19 with Tara Flynn.
I know. It's not good.
I think people
want to
hear about it.
Oh, God, I don't know. Are people sick of me? Yeah. Probably. That's okay, too.
yeah, well, I'm a huge fan of everything you've been doing.
That's very kind. I'm a huge fan of Head Stuff, so it's really, really cool to be here.
Yeah.
I got my Head Stuff mug. I mean, that is the happiest I've been in a long time.
Yeah, you did seem pretty happy.
I was pretty, I cannot hide it. Took a photo, tweeted it immediately, like, I'm here. I've really got a Head Stuff mug.
Now you've made it. I've been aware of you for quite a while. I got into comedy, like, properly, Irish comedy first in about 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I've been kind of aware of you since then.
Yeah, I guess I was doing Stew for Grand Pictures at the time, written by Paul Tillich and Paul Woodfull. Yeah. I mean, that was beginning my life of sort of being on TV, but mainly in wigs and hats, so not getting recognised, which is kind of cool. You know, being on telly and working in loads of different sketches, but not being recognised. I've had people sort of saying, "Oh yeah, I watched you. Yeah." But the sketch I like, you're not in. You say, "Which one is that?" "Oh, it's the one about the DJs." "I am in it." No, she's blonde. Like, okay, I gotcha. All right, that mustn't be me. I wasn't in that one, no. I went to the beginning and then I'm not in the middle of it. Yeah, she's blonde, yeah. That was a €10 wig in Racist B&B. Because obviously we don't have budgets to do those things, so it's all about eBay.
Yeah.
Hot bidding for wigs.
And then roping in everyone you know, your husband.
Yeah, well, asking, so you kind of have to find like-minded people. That's why I was so lucky to find Dermot O'Brien, who's Danger Farm.
Yeah.
Who did most of the videos for me, but it's because he's as angry as I am about stuff. In fact, angrier, you know, in many ways.
Yeah.
But so he can make, you know, he can spin gold out of straw. He's just he's just brilliant at making things look like they that we did have a budget and it wasn't just an all hands on deck. Like, you know, when I'm cooking the breakfast in the Racist B&B sketch, we fed the extras with that actual breakfast.
Oh, really?
It was like that was the level of budget we had.
Yeah, Dermot's great as well, and I saw him there taking photos at your...
Yeah, he was very kind. He double-dobbed for me there, so that was really kind of him. Just got some lovely shots of lovely people. It was a really nice bunch of people at the book launch.
It was such
a nice mix of... There were people there from the Abortion Rights Campaign and the European Network Against Racism, and it's suddenly like, wow, these are all people who do really serious human rights work.
Yeah.
But they're here at my launch. Let's all have a drink. Yay!
Great. As well as... writers and comedians and just people from Twitter and
that was lovely. It was like a sort of a tweet up, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And I'm gonna have her eyes out. That bitch of a national effing treasure, Panty. Panty had her premiere the same night as my book launch, which didn't even deplete my wonderful, amazing pals who fought for marriage equality, but. The film is made by Blinder Films, who make Irish Pictorial Weekly. Oh. So they were all there too. Oh. I'm going to take that bitch down heel by heel. Oh, I'm going to start with the high heels. No, I was thrilled, but I was also really sad I couldn't go. So it was like, it was such a bad clash. Of all the clashes, it was a bad clash.
Yeah,
but I can't wait to see that. It looks so fantastic.
It looks great, doesn't it?
It looks amazing. Queen of Ireland. Cannot wait to see it. But I will take her down still.
Yeah, yeah. We're gonna have to get her on afterwards.
This be my thing? No, you must get her on. Yeah, she is a national fucking treasure.
Well,
damn her. Curse her diary timing.
When did you first kind of come in contact with Panty?
Well, you know, I've always known about Rory and the work as Panty and stuff, but I guess we all sort of stepped up our game, I think, when Rory got targeted over the stuff that was said on the Saturday Night show. I think it certainly motivated me to step up my game a little bit. I had already done a parody video of an anti-equality video. I don't like to name the organisation because I just don't think they're very relevant.
Yeah.
But I had done a parody of an anti-equality organisation's video.
This is the Winstitute?
Before the Winstitute, I had made the Mammy Daddy, case for Mammy Daddy marriage, which was a sort of a Peter and Jane version of marriage.
Yeah.
So I over accepted that idea and went, well, this is actually what you're saying.
Yeah.
If you're really going to take that stance, if you extend that idea, this is where you're going. And it's actually kind of hilarious. So I had already done that, and then I made the Winstitute when it seemed like suing somebody seemed to be what Jesus would do. What would Jesus do? He'd sue. Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that, or many of my Christian pals would agree with that, but it seemed to be the way things were going. Then I really wanted to step up my game in terms of, you know, that whole idea of just standing with people and going, you know, even though I'm not gay and this doesn't directly affect me, it does affect me in terms of a country I live in.
Mm-hmm.
I want there to be equal rights as far as possible. So,
of course,
across the board. So let's all just stand up now and go, right, we've had enough. Let's stand together, even if it doesn't directly affect us. That's how battles are won, I think. Mm. And it's good crack.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you meet cool people.
Yeah. It was pretty amazing, wasn't it?
It was incredible to see.
It was like a festival, not just when it went through, but for the weeks leading up to it, everybody was...
Yeah.
It was exciting.
It was great.
It was exciting because you could feel the tide having turned and people starting to get celebratory. And I'm sure you guys probably did canvassing as well, but on the doorsteps, it really was exciting that the majority of people, you were getting that feeling, don't think it's a done deal just yet, we've got to keep campaigning. But that feeling of, wow... Mostly people are going, but it's going through, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're going, please don't get complacent. You have to get out and vote because it's great that you think that way, but you have to, you know, tick that box.
Yeah, it actually did change from as far as I could see, the campaign changed from vote yes, because at the start it was like, everybody needs to vote yes.
Yeah.
And then it was like, everybody's going to do that. And it was like, okay, don't be complacent.
Yeah, don't
this
be complacent. Please come out on the day.
Yeah.
So it was exciting. And I mean, the day, will we ever forget the 23rd? It was just, couldn't sleep though. Couldn't sleep. And it was funny. I got up and one of my first tweets of the day, one of the first of my many tweets of the day, I was like, isn't it funny? Everyone, you know, 6:30 on a Saturday morning. He was like, isn't it funny? Everyone, all of Irish Twitter seems to be up, almost as if they couldn't sleep for excitement or for some reason. And it really did feel like that thing of, it was from so early on, it seemed like a landslide, the landslide that it was, that people were just so excited. And it was nice after all the hard work, and it was good to just go, oh, this is great. We knew it deep down, and it's just nice to have that sort of affirmation that it was true.
It was great, and all the pictures of everyone coming home to vote and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was amazing.
The army coming over the hill.
Exactly.
Oh, there's loads of us. It was great. It was so great. And it was weird though, on the day I put up a tweet saying, you know, because I was mindful of, I'd been down with mum the week before, down in Kinsale, and we'd gone up to the church with Yes Equality Cork. Had written a lovely letter just saying, you know, consider these other people of great faith that are saying they're voting yes. Mary McAleese, Sister Stan, Peter McVerry, all those. So it was just a really nice, gentle letter. Mm. Not campaigning at all. There was no Yes Equality. No one wore T-shirts or badges or anything. It was just, please consider, as you're examining, you know, your own thought process during the week, that these people of great faith think it's the right thing to do. And there was a little bit of the old shunning, you know, and I was just mindful that my mum was going to be living in a town, quite a small town, with people that knew she had voted yes, and now some of them she was going to know had voted no, because they were quite vocal about it to her. And I sort of was mindful of people of that age group. We all have to live together again now. So I put up a tweet just saying, listen, and if you voted no, don't worry about it. Like, no campaigners, of course, as we all know, I've been quite vocal about them and made satirical videos about them. Very different from someone who voted no and now might feel out of step with the country. And I just wanted to be inclusive and say, listen, even if you voted no, look, the world's not going to end and it's all going to be okay. Everyone's loved and accepted and it's all fine. Well, I got so much flack for saying, oh, you're saying that the no campaigners are fine. And I was like, no, that's not what I'm saying. And you're going to have to go back to my work. Don't jump on one tweet, you duh. It's like one tweet, first of all. And the other thing was, it was just such a throwaway tweet in a way. Just like, and I was just, but I was thinking of my mum. Mm. I was thinking of her neighbours who voted no. You know, I wanted them all to just go, you know, I thought the more of us who get out there, we're like, yes, we campaign for yes. If you voted no, it's not like we're going to put you on a big boat and row you off the island, you know. The whole idea is you still get to do your thing and not be gay if you're not.
Yeah.
You don't have to marry any gays and it's all right and we don't hate you. Because I don't. Some people were led astray by the very emotive, vocal no campaigners. And, you know, that's why it's so insidious and it's a little bit dangerous. And but I wanted to, it was them I was speaking to, not to. And also, who reads my tweets anyway? Who cares?
People do read your tweets.
Well, some naysayers do. But you know what? I always say, get Sky Sports. Just get Sky Sports. I'm not going to be your hobby. You might as well pay for it. And then you can watch some hurling or some, I don't know, just get off my feed. Get a life.
Maybe we can put the actual campaigners, though, the no campaigners, on a big boat.
I wouldn't mind that, but I, you know, let's try and be inclusive through gritted teeth.
Yeah, but are they going to be inclusive on the next thing that comes up? Probably not.
What do you mean, the next thing that comes up? Where are you going with that? Like, we don't know.
Like the first chapter in this book here.
What book? Oh, a book. Yes, a book. A book.
Giving out. Yeah. Abortion. We won't say the word abortion.
Abortion. It's funny. So I'd written the first chapter long before I ever told my own story. And if listeners don't know, I told my own story and you gave me a lovely platform to write a bit about the reaction to telling my own story of traveling to Holland for an abortion 9 years ago. But I had already written the chapter for the book, abortion. Don't say the A word. You know, you must not talk about it. If you talk about it, there's just going to be shouting. And actually, that chapter now, it holds up. It needs to be included because people still don't want us to talk about it. But there hasn't been much shouting. I think you even encountered that via the your own Twitter feed for Head Stuff. The reaction to the article is mainly support.
Yeah, there's one guy.
But
loads of support.
There's always one.
Isn't it amazing, though? Even 10 years ago, we'd really have dithered over even whether to include an article like that because it would be so inflammatory. It's not inflammatory. No. And that's the new message is, people may not, again, like with marriage equality or anything else, that you are diametrically opposed to. If you're opposed to it, it won't touch your life, hopefully. Yeah. You don't have to have an abortion if, yeah. If it's not medical care you would ever choose. But the truth is most people are now up for letting the woman, her family, the doctor involved, but mainly the woman, decide.
Yeah.
They don't want to meddle in that.
Yeah.
And the story out there is that we've spoken about it, and I spoke about it, Roisin Ingle spoke about it. Loads of people have been speaking about it for a long time, but getting brushed aside. It's because they've either told their stories anonymously or they just haven't had a platform or been a more recognisable face or whatever. And it's very easy to brush those people aside, which is awful. The women from Termination for Medical Reasons, they've told their stories for a long time now. And if we're not listening to them, we're really going to have to step up in terms of the politicians. I think the country is. I think the country hears those stories and is going, we cannot let these people who have unviable pregnancies and are choosing to terminate them have to travel on top of it.
Yeah.
It's just cruel. That is cruelty, blatant cruelty. But they haven't been stirred into action by them. The politicians haven't. I do think the country's listening to them and it's causing the sea change we're all feeling. But they've bravely told their stories, really shocking, it's the right word to use, tragic stories, and they haven't stung people into action. But my other thought on that is, you know, we can't just focus on fetal abnormalities, though they should be the urgent and most pressing one. Mm. The truth is that women are putting their lives at risk because they can't cope with a pregnancy for whatever reason. And that's down to the individual. But I can't say what constitutes a crisis pregnancy.
Yeah.
You can't. No one can but the person who's experiencing it as a crisis. And we have to have medical health care for all of them.
Yeah.
Instead of going, this is the worst bit about it for me. It's not like we're going, oh, we didn't know. I loved your piece that you ran with Claire Daly, you know, where she says, she lists the facts and then she says, but we all know, but everyone knows this.
Yeah.
That's the truth. We all know it's happening. And we've been sitting there going, well, sure, it'll fix itself. Or, well, it won't, turns out. Unless we speak up, the politicians aren't going to act on it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The main thing, obviously, is it's the woman's choice.
It has to be.
It has to be. And that's what the pro-lifers are going to be saying all the time. It's just... They never even talk about that. It's always talking about the baby.
And you see, the thing is, according to my beliefs, it's not a baby yet, especially in the very, very early stages. It has potential to be. Mm. That's my personal philosophy. I'm not saying for one second that it's headstuffs or anyone else's in this room. That's my philosophy. That's what I believe, is that most abortions take place in the first 12 weeks. Mm. And there is potential for a person. Mm. It's not a person yet, no more than a sperm or an egg on their own are, no more than a recently fertilized egg is. Yeah. That's what I believe. Now, many, many people believe something different, then it would never be a procedure for them or an option for them. But they can't impose their philosophy on the entire country. That is my feeling.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to keep saying that. I'm not suggesting it's yours or that it needs to be anyone else's, but I just think we can't meddle in such a huge decision.
Yeah.
Because for me, though, the decision was clear for me because of my own beliefs. It wasn't easy. And that's what I hate about when people talk about it. Also, oh, it was yours is one of those lifestyle abortions. And you're like, well, way to diminish and undermine something that was a massive, massive moment in my life. A huge thing to have to contemplate, to weigh up all the options and then be sort of misogynistically sidelined as, well, you obviously didn't even think about adoption. You didn't think. It's like, no, you think of everything. Mm-hmm. It's a massive weight. Mm-hmm. And then you make the choice that the only choice you can make for you in that moment. That's the only way to describe it. And I get very angry when people try to say, oh, the best choice for you. Why didn't you, why don't we bring back Magdalene Laundries while we're at it, you know? Yeah. Why don't we, we are shipping women off. And I think it just makes me very angry and sad that people still feel entitled to speak that way about something that was so, so huge, you know, for me. Huge decision, and I didn't take it lightly. I didn't make it lightly, and we've got to move on from that kind of talk.
Yeah, and that's probably the biggest sea change, I think. You know, the way that you're saying that kind of the tide has shifted in the country. And
it certainly feels like that.
It does feel like that. And I think that most of the people that are pro-choice and that would vote yes if we got a referendum on it probably wouldn't choose to have an abortion as well.
But yeah, exactly.
They probably that wouldn't.
Being pro-choice does not mean you would ever choose an abortion yourself.
Yeah.
And you won't know until you have a crisis pregnancy. I certainly didn't. Hmm. I had no plan. You know, I didn't have my emergency, you know, bag packed just in case for flying off to get the lifestyle choicey plan. No, I mean, you know, that's I'm you know, being a bit facetious there. But what I'm trying to say is I didn't know until I was faced with it. I knew that I didn't ever want to. I was pro-choice. I knew I never wanted to meddle in someone else's decision. The thought of even putting my spoke in and someone else's face, put someone else's to do with their own body is like, that was why I was pro-choice. When I was faced with the decision myself, there was no other, you know, we say choice. It doesn't feel like a choice very often when you're faced with a crisis pregnancy. Mm-hmm. It seems like the only option for you, for your, you know, the only option that's right for you.
But it's just having the understanding. I think, isn't it just, if you're pro-choice, even, you know, as you say, you might necessarily have an abortion yourself, but it's having the understanding that other people might need that, you know. The same way as even in the referendum, the marriage referendum, you know, even if you're not gay or, you know, but you understand people.
Yeah, people are different.
People want to have, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's a you know, that's the one of the only ways it correlates with the marriage equality referendum, except that it is, you know, big social change. But is that this will probably, this doesn't have to affect you at all.
Yeah.
But it will affect someone else.
Yeah.
Women have always needed abortions since humans have existed. They always will. And all you're doing if you are insisting on not having it here is you're delaying them. You're making them less safe. But you're not preventing them. So it makes, it just makes no sense oppose it.
Yeah.
So I'd rather, I don't want to know, and you know, hearing Mara Clark from the Abortion Support Network speak at various events recently, the Abortion Support Network helps women who are, who either can't afford the procedure or they've attempted the procedure themselves. And I wrote about this in the Head Stuff article, but it's hearing what she has to say. They are the ones who see the women after they've drunk a bottle of bleach. They've taken everything in their medicine cabinet. They've thrown themselves down the stairs. They've crashed their cars in the hope that they will lose the pregnancy but not kill themselves. I'm sorry to be on such a downer here, but we need to acknowledge that those things are happening today in Ireland because abortion's not available. And people will do whatever they have to in a crisis pregnancy that they want to end. They will do it themselves if they have to. And I can't sit here and know that that's happening and not say we need abortion here. We need it urgently. And I'm going to say again that for the women facing into pregnancies with fetal abnormalities, that we have to deal with that yesterday. That has to be the first one. But let us not forget the other women who are going to harm themselves while it's not available.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the main, I suppose, the difference between the two referendums, if we get the second one, is that the first one is obviously very joyous and it was such a great occasion, like a festival, like I said. I even, that day, was it the Saturday when it went through, it was like Patrick's Day in Dublin, but yeah, without the fighting and without, you know, people getting sick all over the place. Just people were kissing and hugging and it was just amazing.
It was lovely.
This would be, I think, also very, very important for human rights, you know, women's rights, body autonomy, all that stuff. But it wouldn't be a celebration in the same way. I mean, it's not like...
No, I mean, I personally, I would just feel...
And that makes it much harder, I think.
Yeah, it's a harder sell if you're looking at it from a kind of a purely how do we talk to people about it. Yeah, it's not love. It's not. But although I see it as a little bit about love, I say it's about loving our women, you know. And I know there'll be people listening or people looking for holes in what I say, saying, "What about love for the unborn?" And you see, I have to bring it back to those are your beliefs, person listening. Those are your beliefs. I believe the love has to be for the born person who's already here and who's in crisis. particularly during the early weeks. And during later weeks, it's usually abortions that happen are usually because of some really, really dire medical reasons. And so that has to be, again, between the woman and her doctor. But it's a harder sell. But I think it can be about love. I really do. I think it can be about cherishing women who are in crisis.
Absolutely. And the other side of it as well is that doesn't really get talked about maybe is sometimes people that maybe just shouldn't be parents and definitely aren't ready to be parents. Is that child, if it has to be born, going to be loved the same way?
I mean, there are lots of pro-choice arguments, very strong pro-choice arguments. And if anyone's interested, there's a book called Pro by Katha Pollitt, which I could highly recommend, mm-hmm. which lays them out in very strong pro-choice terms. It's a very interesting read if people aren't used to talking about choice issues. Mm. But it is, I mean, there are all kinds of philosophies. But you see, the other thing is this isn't about convincing people of my philosophy or yours. Yeah. This is about if you believe it is already a person, the moment of conception, we're never going to agree. But it would still be great if you would not impose that on someone else who doesn't believe the same.
Yeah.
You know, so the philosophies, while I find them interesting and I have my own, I actually think we can't really bring them in because the whole point is everyone is different.
Yeah.
Everyone's varying degrees of pro-choice or pro or anti-choice. That's actually not the issue. The issue is we have to leave it down to the individual's beliefs, whatever they are.
Yeah. Because I want to bring up religion at some point with you.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah.
A lot of the pro-life people are... religion
and
is
I say anti-choice because that would be my chosen term because because I'm not anti-life.
No, exactly. Yeah,
I'm not anti-pregnancy. Yeah. I'm not anti-babies, and all that stuff is propaganda. You see,
yeah, it is.
That's never heard it put that way before, actually.
Yeah,
no, that's
anti-choice.
Yeah.
No, anti-choice.
I don't like the word. I don't like the word.
People say.
Yeah, I hate the word pro-life, but it's the word that's being used. And
because I'm not
right,
anti-life, but you know, and I know a lot of people who are anti-choice don't like that term, but it's like, well, I don't like the term pro-abort, which is the you know, because I'm not pro-abortion.
No.
And some people say, well, why not reclaim that? And say, well, I am pro-abortion in certain circumstances because it's the right thing in certain... I don't like that term, but, you know, I think either you approve of a woman's right to choose or you don't.
Yeah.
So you're pro or anti-choice is how I feel about it.
Yeah, so the anti-choice people will be kind of... You know, they see it as abortions for all. And it's clearly that's not
Or that they'll be imposed on people.
Yeah.
See, this is all about consent, really.
Yeah.
You know... My mum was talking about my dad had dementia. He died in March. Right up until the very end, even though he had dementia, he was still asked his consent for any procedure, a blood test, anything. He was still asked for his consent. Is it all right if I take this sample now? You know, and this is the only medical procedure where people aren't asked for their consent, and in fact, their consent is denied. So, if you know, in terms of we're not allowed to have one if we want. But so if this procedure came in here and was legal here, you couldn't have one without giving consent.
Yeah.
Like any other medical procedure, you have to sign a form. If you have your appendix out, you will have to consent. So we need to there are a lot of myths, and that's one of them, that there will be forced abortions. There won't, like any other medical procedure, like a blood test, like a flu shot, you have to give your consent. So that's a simple one to clear up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and these are all the points we just need to maybe highlight a bit more.
Yeah.
Like the complacency one in the marriage referendum. So a lot of these anti-choice people, we're going to call them from now on.
Well, that's what the pro-choice movement uses. And I think it's a really good, clear thing to say.
Yeah,
and it's not disrespectful.
No.
Just saying
no.
You are against my right to choose. I'm not for abortion.
Yeah.
You are against my right to choose. You know, not you. You're lovely. No, you're great. You guys are cool.
Yeah. But one of the arguments that I've had kind of thrown at me from the anti-choice, and they're not all religious, but a lot of a lot of the time they can be.
It is a religious ideology.
Yes.
So
ideology.
That is where the fervor stems from a lot. But, you know, it isn't all at all by any means, as you say.
No, absolutely. It's just a point. It's just one of them that got thrown at me is the choice, and we're saying pro-choice, and then they say, but what about the choice of the baby, you know? And as we, you know, we say it's not a baby yet, first of all.
Yeah.
Secondly, religion's always, you know, like baptism, where's the baby's choice in that? And all yeah. these other things, they don't make these choices.
Yeah.
So it's just really hypocritical.
Well, it's also very emotive. And that's the other thing, you know, who doesn't want to protect a baby?
Yeah.
Like we all do. But so when language like that is used, it's a way to shut down any more discussion. Mm. And I find it a little bit offensive, to be honest. I know that a lot of anti-choice people say, well, I find your stance offensive. That's okay. I'm going to take that on the chin. I don't think what I'm saying is offensive. But, you know, saying things like, it's terms that have been used on about me recently, that I'm a baby killer. I'm an unrepentant abortionist. I'm a murderer. I'm a child murderer. You know, for instance, and I don't want to share the details too much. I've already shared enough. But for instance, when I termination happened at 9 weeks, it would have happened even earlier if I'd been able to access the procedure here. At 9 weeks, there is no sentience. You know, there are no limbs. It's the size of a grape. So these pictures that the anti-choice side uses in their posters and things of, you know, very often they're early deliveries of very late term babies. It's again, I have to just ask people to consider the source. Somebody wrote to me during the week and said, but what about the fact that you can hear the baby crying as it's aborted? And I was like, you need to consider the source you're hearing that yeah. from, and you need to just have a think about how that could be even possible, you know. And but then again, you just have to really think about the fact that the majority happens in the first 12 weeks. And, you know, it's just not what I believe. It's just if you think contraception is all right, and if you think the morning after pill is all right, then you are only talking about another matter of weeks. Hmm. And I don't see the sense in that. Yeah. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, just when you were talking about people being offended there, have you heard, it reminded me of the Stephen Fry quote. Do you know the Stephen?
No.
I just got it up here. He's got a great quote about just being offended. This is Stephen Fry quote. It's now very common to hear people say that I'm rather offended by that, as if it gives them certain rights. It's no more than a whine. I find that offensive. It has no meaning. It has no purpose. It has no reason to be respected as a phrase. I'm offended by that. Well, so fucking what?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of that. But I mean, I certainly don't set out to offend with any of the work I do. I don't set out to offend. But I find, especially when someone is trying to control somebody else somehow, and it could be through racism, through sexism, through emotive language, anti-choice language, it can be all kinds of ways to try and shut down someone's dialogue or stop them speaking or stop them doing something, or stop them acting, even stop them, you know, acting on their beliefs. Anytime I hear that, you know, I just go, that's when I try to address it and say, no, this is what you're doing. You're attempting to control. But often they will use I'm offended by that as a way to shut down. Now, I'm not setting out to offend anybody. I'm deeply sorry if I've offended anybody who's just a bystander. But when people are acting to keep people silenced, I don't care if you're offended. You must stop doing that.
Yeah. And that's what you know? Claire Daly said in the article.
Yeah, that's a wonderful article.
It's control. It's not.
It is control. Quality. It's control. And yeah. and it's the, you know, it keeps coming around. It's control. It's not trusting women. Mm. Just leave it with us, lads. Listen. We're actually great.
Yeah.
We're not murderers. We don't want to murder anyone. Well, there are some born people I can think of that I, you know, if I were a hitman, I might move up the list. But no, it's, you know, it's no. It's definitely something. It's definitely control. And we just all, let's all live and let live in terms of, if it's my body, I get to choose what happens to it. And. Yeah. You know, there's every chance. Many people who have abortions go on when they're ready to have families.
Hmm.
You know, oh, actually, Mara said a wonderful thing the other day. Mara Clark from the Abortion Support Network. She's a mum, and she said, you know, motherhood is an honour. She said, parenting's an honour, and it should be chosen.
Hmm.
You know, it isn't a punishment because you had sex. You know, and you know, that whole thing, I've had so much, you know, misogynistic abuse. That's usually the level of abuse that I get since this, although it's been, the majority's been support. But it's sort of like, why didn't you, you know, I had this in the article I sent to you guys. You know, why didn't you close your legs, you slut? Yeah. Well, no, I won't, because I want to have sex, thanks very much. Why didn't you use contraception? I've been around a very long time. I know, I've tried all the different kinds and mostly they work. You know, but life isn't clear cut or plannable a lot of the time. Accidents happen, stuff breaks down, things don't work. I took a morning after pill to be sure. It didn't work. Things can happen, guys. And then you've got to, you know, if you're not ready to parent, you shouldn't have to parent. It's that simple to me.
I mean, in this country, you have to have a license for a television and a dog.
Yeah.
You actually have to plan to have a dog or a television, but you don't have to plan to give birth and be a mother.
No, and it should be a privilege and an honour and chosen and a big joyous occasion.
Absolutely.
Not a sentence because you had sex and through no fault of your own possibly, or even let's say someone just decided to have unprotected sex. I wouldn't advise it, but let's say they did. People do. You still don't get, you're not condemned to pregnancy or condemned to motherhood if that's not your choice. Mm. Because it shouldn't be a condemnation. No. That, to me, also diminishes the incredible art of motherhood. Yeah. So don't you be talking about my friends who are mothers and saying that it's a punishment for, you know, having the sex.
Yeah.
Back off, mofos.
Yeah.
No.
And my mother, who's the best mother in the world.
Right. See? That. But you are actually, to me, that's an insult to motherhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
And that's one of the other things, just the kind of the control and everything. To me, that's all religion is. We'll cut that out. That's all religion is. It's just control. I suppose the man trying to control the people. And when I was reading this book, your great book, Giving Out Yards.
Oh, thank you. See, I give out yards. It's an Irish art form.
It definitely suits. But it struck me that kind of a lot of the issues that we're still dealing with is because of religion. Now, I don't know what your point of view on it is.
Yeah,
that is how I feel.
I feel like you feel like you're right in terms of, and I mean, what I've tried to put it all in under is the shushing. Shushing is what it's called in the book, because I found out that I discovered early on that writing about the word oppression isn't funny. It's just too goddamn oppressing.
Yeah, interesting, that, isn't it?
It's oppressive. So I've come up with this almost a side character in Your Grand as well, my first book, but the shushing. The shushing is ways of control. And some of that was religious. Some of it was through, through political shushing. Sexism is another form of shushing. Oppression, basically. But funny oppression.
Yeah. Lighter.
Yeah, I do think a lot of it was religious oppression. I do personally. I do. Now, I have some friends who are very strong faith. I don't want to take that away from them or undermine their beliefs at all. But I think it's a very hardened heart who wouldn't say that the institution of the church, not the faith, the institution of the church didn't do great damage here in this country. And we're still coming out of the shadow of it. Yeah. And that's a lot of what, actually, you could sum the book up that way.
Yeah.
It's the anger of shrugging off the shame cloak and going, well, we're not going to be ashamed anymore. We're going to stand up straight and tall and go, actually, we're great. And we are going to give out yards about everything, including the shushing. Mm. And that's not to denigrate anyone's faith. It is to say that the institution of the Catholic Church in Ireland, mainly the Catholic Church, other churches too, but mainly the Catholic Church, has left us with a residue we're still dealing with.
Mm. Yeah, like there is a difference between religion and the church, like being religious and the actual, people who are operated.
There's people who stepped up during the marriage equality campaign and said, we are people of great faith and we're going to be voting yes, that we find that falls under our faith to be charitable and loving. Mm. So I think, it's a good distinction to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I think it's I respect, people's right to believe whatever they want. But that doesn't mean I respect the church or the religion itself.
Yeah, that's and I'd be in very similar stance to you. And I definitely don't respect an imposition of that faith on the general populace if they don't share it.
Yeah, because even when you were saying that the shushing was, maybe mainly
It's because I can't help but laugh. If this can slip into common parlance, this will be my work here is done.
It just sounds like a M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Yeah. Let's make The Shushing, starring Liam Neeson as the Great Mist.
Mark Wahlberg, it won't be Liam Neeson. Although he did voice that great video.
He did, yeah. Graham Linehan's video, Chains, for Amnesty.
And that was also a great interview as well. And them coming in on the campaign is brilliant.
Yeah, completely selfless. I think it's really brave what they've done because, first of all, they were able to access the care. Mm. Secondly, they've got a family now. And as Helen Linehan herself was saying at the launch, you know, she said, I've moved on. It's actually not a sad story. She said, you know, I know I'm upset in the clip, but she said, you know, it was actually weirdly a good ending for me because I got the care I needed quickly and then moved on, you know, and had the family later. And so they were very generous to do that. I think it was an incredibly selfless move because they can't get over that it's still happening here.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So, and such, you know, kind of, like strong voices to have and you know, so well known as well. And then to get Liam Neeson too, I mean,
yeah,
all that stuff.
And then, of course, people are going to say, oh, why do we need blokes who don't even live here anymore? Well, unfortunately, we do, because like we said earlier, that the women from Termination for Medical Reasons can go on every platform in this country. They've been on TV, they've been on radio, they give interviews in the press, and no one's done anything.
Mm.
No one, it hasn't even sort of shaken up the national discussion because of the shushing. But what it has, as we say, it has, people have heard those stories and gone, no, that's not right. Mm. And it has shifted public opinion. So I'm really grateful to them for telling their stories, even though they probably felt like it was pointless almost because no one seemed to be listening. Or they were listening, like, you know, they can talk to X or Y or Z on a big national radio station and still no one acted. So it's going to... So we need these famous faces.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think just the nature of viral can't be undermined at all.
Oh, yeah.
It's hugely important. It was massively important in the equality campaign when Panties... I feel oppressed video, that went completely viral.
Yeah.
And that made a massive difference.
It made a huge difference. And it also showed people, and I speak about that in the book, in Giving Out Yards, the massive help I think the internet has been in changing Ireland. Because there were loads of things that we didn't talk about because of the shushing.
Mm.
We were shushened, and so we didn't talk about it. And I certainly often felt alone in my thinking. So to know there were other people out there, it emboldened me to speak and then to act. And the internet cannot reduce the role it's played in that.
Absolutely.
Connection.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, the village square is much bigger now. And even if it seems like there are lots of people in the village square thinking one way, as soon as a few hands go up, go, actually, I don't think that. Hand up, I don't think that. And then more hands go up and say, yeah, we're with you.
Yeah. When did you kind of get involved with social media? When did you?
That's a good question about which I haven't really thought. I think I started messing about on MySpace whenever was around 1912, something like that. 1912 to 1914, towards the end of the beginning of the Great War. Then I moved to Facebook partly because I moved. I think it was 2006 when I moved to England, and it was a great way to stay in touch with everyone back home.
Mm-hmm.
It was really primarily for that. Then it became for work, really, just letting people know. When I got disillusioned with it was like letting people know when things were happening and, you know, putting up the odd photographs, but private photographs. So I've got a secret account for that. No nudies, but they're private, like wedding photographs and stuff. So I do use Facebook mainly for work now, but also staying. Now I've moved back from England, obviously, and now I stay in touch with my UK friends through that and friends in the US and stuff. But mainly for work. And then Twitter, 2009. I hopped on that bandwagon, held on tight, and I still really enjoy it. I always liken it to, you know, when you open a door, and Twitter is like opening a huge big door.
Mm.
So, you know, and out through that door, there are amazing things to see and do and people to connect with. If you open a door, slugs might get in.
Yeah.
But you know, if it's only a few slugs, you can handle it. And they tend to only be a few slugs. And the mute button is the person who invented mute on Twitter deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. They deserve a Nobel Peace Prize immediately.
Okay, we'll write down a proposal and we'll send it into the Nobel Committee.
That guy or gal, let's find them.
Because you're obviously very vocal on Twitter now. And you've been there since 2009. Maybe it's just, I don't, maybe I wasn't following you on Twitter in 2009.
What, you cray cray?
I wasn't on Twitter in 2009. Is 2009 when it started?
I think it was probably way earlier, but there were three. Actually, Kieran in the book.
It wasn't that early, though.
He was the second or third. He was the third person ever to join Twitter, or so he says. Kieran, the keyboard warrior.
Yeah.
He's one of the slugs. I would be muting Kieran, but he was fun to write. I've been vocal. I've been more vocal recently because I just feel like we have to use it for all kinds of things. I try and find a balance. I don't want to just spam people with gig details or book stuff, though you have to use it for that. It's your job. People say, oh, you should talk about the book a bit less. I'm going, no, it's my job. That's my work. only use Twitter to have fights with people, good luck to you.
Yeah.
I don't use it for that. And then it is a great way to connect with people. And they if they feel they want to have a say at your face, they'll do it. But usually it's respectful or a bit of crack, even if you don't agree. But if the people don't agree and they just, as I say, if they become Kieran and it's apparent they're Kieran, and I'll usually check out their own feed, to see if I'm just missing tone in one tweet. But if the rest of it is attacks on other people, and then that's when I go, get Sky Sports. So maybe one response, if it's not super abusive, just to say that I've seen it and I'm not shutting you down. I'm gonna respond, but I'm not gonna engage because I've seen your timeline. You know, I don't say that, but I just then I mute.
I saw that happening on the Headstuff feed when that one person got in touch. You gave one fair reply, and then he obviously didn't stop.
Yeah,
and so you're, okay, that's it. I'm done.
Yeah, I'm done.
And then after that, all he does is then he starts going to other people from Headstuff.
Exactly,
like other editors and writers.
This is it. You see, it's usually someone out for a bit of a. They're on a bit of a campaign to get a response or but they're not up for dialogue.
No.
It's not like I'm entitled, and this is what Twitter is an open forum, but I liken it to I'm in the pub, I'm sitting there with my friends, and I'm chatting. Someone who overhears me say something, because I say it in the pub, they're entitled to go, oh, I overheard what you said there and here's my 2 cents. I'm equally entitled to go, that's great, and we either get into a conversation because it happens organically, or I'm entitled to say, actually, I'm having a pint with my friends right now. I am entitled to say, I'm not going to engage with this particular line because I think you're looking for a fight and I don't do Twitter spats. Mm. That's one of my only policies. I don't do Twitter spats.
Yeah.
I won't. It's
a good policy.
You know, so if you're out for a spat, mute, you know.
I imagine a lot of these people don't really care that much as well about the actual issue that they're arguing about. Or, you know what I mean?
I have no idea. It's so hard to tell on Twitter.
Well, if you look at some people and you look through, you know, as you say, look through their feed and it's like abuse at this, abuse at this, abuse at that. It's kind of just like...
Sometimes it is just abuse. Sometimes, yeah. And sometimes it is someone who has a particular bugbear, or a particular campaign. And I respect that to some degree. But I think there is a way of discussing things forward. And there's a way of discussing things that is an attempt to shut the other person down. I guess what I'm saying, and I'm just forming this theory here, is that I'm constantly battling the shushing. So if someone's attempting to shushen me, I will re-shushen them with the mute button. It's the shushing button. I'm taking the shushing back and I'm using it against them.
I see a three picture deal here.
Yeah.
Trilogy of the shushing.
The shushing one, the calm.
Yeah,
shushing two, the storm. The shushing three,
and then a relaunch 20 years later.
Yeah.
it's kind of a great word to have invented because it does make it easier to talk about, and it is a real thing.
It is a real thing.
It is a real
thing. Yeah, it is. And I wanted to talk about... So, although, you know, look, it's a funny book. It's fun and there's loads of jokes. But as you've said, and even Roisin Ingle said at the launch, you know, sometimes it made me sad and sometimes it made me angry.
Yeah.
Because it is satirical. Sometimes there are... I try to give equal weight to the heavy topics like abortion. But what I examine in the book is the silence surrounding it. ironically, because I opened my big fat mouth since writing that. But so I'll give potholes equal weight, you know, so that the anger that we have about all the topics are on the same level. Because it's funnier that way. It's funnier to say seagulls are as important as as homelessness. They're not. But comedically, it's fun to take that stance that everything's really super important, including the important things. But then when you take on the important things with satire, there's got to be anger, and unfortunately, even though there might be some good jokes in there, they might not be, this is going to sound weird, but they might not be super laugh out loud funny. Although, you know, that we saw at the launch, I did read something that where the darkest bit got the biggest laugh. And that's often the way with satire, but the laugh is then a release because there's recognition. We kind of go, yeah, that is something, that is a problem here. So I think a lot of satire is like that.
Absolutely.
So I apologise if my anger seeps all the way through the book, but I hope there's a good bit of crack in there too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's a very enjoyable read, it is very funny, but it's also very satirical, and it's very on point as well. I mean, nowadays, like what's going on in this country, you know, there is a lot to give out about, like potholes and seagulls.
Yeah, yes. The pressing issues. Yeah, yes.
But there's also, and the very important things are things like women's rights and the abortion and, the marriage referendum and all these different things come up in it. And none of them seem out of place. And they are all things that we give out about.
Great, thank you. That's a relief, to be honest, because it's only been out for a week and obviously I haven't met that many people that have read it yet.
Yeah.
That's a huge relief, because that was a huge goal, because you know it's a fun formatted book, like it's got a jolly little purple cover. But I didn't want to sell anything short either.
Yeah.
But it had to be discussed. So
absolutely, and it's not only discussed; it's kind of bookended by it, by like a borscht as I got, you know. So
my agenda does kind of come in there, and my agenda, by the way, is just equality. It's equality.
That's it,
and that's my agenda. So when people are going to go, oh yeah, you're driving your agenda. Well, my agenda is equality. You know, that's it.
But then at the same time, you know, you've got the character, so it's not just you talking. Yes. And you give a lot of space to Mairead.
Yes, I do. Mairead, who loves the sound of her own voice.
Absolutely.
But I will also say this, there's a bit of me in all the characters too. So when people say, is that based on X or Y? And I go, well, you know, sometimes they're an amalgam of a few people, and there's always a little bit of me in there too, of course. So even I get to get my Kieran on, and you know, there's a very lefty hippie woman called Scommel Despair, D-E-S-P-E Father I-R. So Cloud of the Sky or Scommel Despair. You get it. Works on all the levels. And Scommel would be, you know, Scommel would share many of the politics I have, but she's really annoying.
Yeah.
I'm probably really annoying too. But what I'm saying is that Scommel is one of those people who really wears it on her sleeve and only talks about, like, she doesn't ever want to talk about a TV show, or she needs you to know her politics immediately. She had to go in there too. So I tried to find, a bit of balance. So Mairead gets a lot of time, but Mairead was just so fun to write.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And she's a vociferous writer of letters, and she's the kind of person who likes to complain, really likes to complain. And that's the character name, Mairead, who likes the sound of her own voice. And so she'll happily go on the radio all the time. Whereas Sean, the religious farmer, he'll vent spleen every now and again, but he's actually a really nice person.
Yeah.
And quite progressive.
Yeah.
You know, but Mairead just wants to rattle on.
Yeah.
You know.
For a lot of it, I was trying to decide who I dislike more between Scommel and Mairead.
See, but they're just kind of polar opposites, really.
They are, but they're both so annoying.
Yeah. Right, yes! Awesome! The only nice character is Sean, the religious farmer.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's lovely. Nice, he can be wrong, but he's lovely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. They can all be wrong.
So I think you nailed all the characters.
Oh, thank you.
And it's really, a really clever part of the book, I think, because, you know, it gets other people. It's not just you kind of blabbering on.
In fact,
it gets the other voices.
I never say me. I say we.
That's right.
It's something we decided for the last book. It was an editorial decision. I had a lot more personal sort of I think in the last book. And the editor actually suggested Kira Considine from Hachette.
Yeah.
It was a great suggestion to sort of set it even more in the self-help book style of we the people believe, or this is a given, this is, of course, this is a national crisis, you know, like the right brown bread recipe, you know. So it sort of sets it up as a received wisdom or something, and it does strengthen the whole idea of these things as a national conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was a great steer.
Yeah.
So I kept that for this book. And but then I thought, but wouldn't it be great to just have, because with the improv that I do and stuff, the Dublin Comedy Improv, one of my favourite things, and having an acting background, is playing characters. So I wondered, could I, even though it wasn't ostensibly a fiction book, it is a makey-uppy book. And I thought, if it's makey-uppy, then I can have some makey-uppy voices. And that was great crack.
Yeah, yeah. And the actual process of writing it, how long had you been thinking about it? And how long did it take to write? And when does kind of Kira come into the process?
Oh, fairly early on. Very early on, in fact, because I think the she taught me something with the first book, because last year was the first book, and the reason they've come so quickly on each other is because they're actually sort of similar.
Year between them, was it?
Yeah, 1 year in between them.
Yeah.
But so similar in terms of your grand was looking at women, Irish women, and how we've coped with the shushing, mm-hmm. and how we are awesome. And if we can be this awesome despite the shushing, we should share this wisdom with the rest of the world. So many of the topics were kind of visited. I tried to bring brand new topics in here. It's another reason for the voices, is to bring it somewhere new. Mm. But I thought, well, we're grand despite all the things that we give out about. I was like, oh, what about really examining all the things we give out about? So it was sort of a flip side of being grand about things was not being grand about things.
Yeah, yeah.
So I suppose it's the shushing to not grand. So your grand is your shushing grand, giving out, or it is the shushing to not grand. So it's kind of, so they were topics that were already in my subconscious and on my whiteboard.
Right.
Which is why the turnaround was possible. But yeah, Kira gets involved very early, or certainly did in the first one, because she said, if you really have a clear idea of, don't just write things and then we'll try and shape it later. She said, have a shape first. Such a good steer. Have a shape first, and then the writing will sort of fall into it. Because it was not the way my brain works, that I just start writing and see where it goes.
Yeah.
But having the shape, even having, you know, the sections on the whiteboard, and sort of then knowing which to put in what section, gave it a shape really fast.
Yeah.
So the subjects were there, and subjects are there, the shape is there, then you, it sounds easy, but you just have to sit down and write. Now, that might mean getting up at 5 a.m. and you know, doing 4 hours before you have to do other things. Might mean you have a whole day and you can do an 8 hour day, you know, or you only have an hour. You still have to do the discipline of the writing, but it makes it a lot simpler, I suppose, simpler structurally.
Absolutely.
So, and she's absolutely fantastic, Kira Constantine. She's always said to me, you know, Lee, you know, make sure you know, even though this is on paper a Christmas stocking book that you wants to be really, you know, really fun, lots of jokes, but she said, don't lose the old lefty feminist bits, you know, keep them in.
Absolutely.
So she's fantastic, and to give me that scope was lovely, because it wouldn't have been my voice without that, you know. I couldn't have written just a fluffy book. You know?
Yeah. And a word that Roisin Ingle kept saying when she was launching the book was important. She kept saying it.
I'm wary of that one. That's a lot of pressure.
I know, but I agree with her, because while it could kind of seem like a stocking book, as you call it.
Yeah, which it is. It is that too.
Yeah, but at the same time, if the book was, you know, somebody's just getting something for their mother and it ends up in, you know, real life Mairead's hands, all of a sudden she might be reading this and then, you know, start opening up or changing her mind or reading things from different people's point of view. And I think that does make it kind of important.
Wow, that's really kind of you, and also terrifying.
Well, you don't have to worry about it now. It's done. You've written
it. It's
done
now. It's out there now. Yeah, that's, my work here is done. Yeah, that's very kind of you. I would love to think it might even just start some conversations. That would be great. But it's already more than the brief, which is just, you know, make people laugh and have a bit of a think. But if it started some conversations, that would be fantastic. And I did want it to be, you know, something a little bit different than other analyses of Ireland. And so for that, because there are loads of those and they're fantastic ones. Actually, if you haven't read it yet, Colm Tobin's new book, Surviving Ireland, it's great. Top recommendation. It's so good. And you talk bite and funny.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
That's Twitter Colm Tobin as opposed to Colm Tobin.
Not Colm Tobin. No, Twitter and comedy writing.
Yes.
Colm Tobin.
Yes.
He writes for Irish Victoria Weekly too, so
yeah.
That's how we'd kind of know each other. But that's another analysis of Ireland, but they're very, very different in tone.
Okay.
And so I would say buy them as companion pieces.
But buy yours first.
Marketing done.
And so what was the writing actually? Were you getting up at 5 in the morning? Was it?
Sometimes, yeah. And I actually had a bit of a strange one. I wrote a piece for writing.ie. I'm not sure if they'll use it. I just sent it in, but about the process, because it was very different this year because my dad died in March. Very complacent. I've got my material. The whiteboard is full. Mm-hmm. I've got my Liveline podcast so I can look at the most common recurring topics that people give out about coming up again and again. Tick, wonderful, tick, tick. And I've got the discipline. I get up and I just write and I hit my word count for the day. Well, that all goes when you're bereaved. My brain stopped working. So there were a couple of months where I was doing the writing, but I was kind of barely remembering it. Now it turned out, luckily, the old subconscious was ticking away. Again, back to the planning, because the plan was there. Yeah. Something was coming out. Yeah. Whereas if I'd been just sitting down going, I don't know what I'm going to work on today, it might not have happened. I might have missed the deadline completely. But luckily, Hachette were incredibly compassionate and generous. I missed a couple of deadlines, but we managed to make it up in the last couple of drafts.
Yeah. I mean, if you still get it out within a year, I think it's okay.
I mean, it was. There were moments I thought it's not going to be possible because, you know, just emotionally I wasn't. You know that great Irish phrase, "I'm not able." There were days I was just, "I'm not able." but with the generosity of the publishers and a bit of a, you know, once I started to feel better, kicking myself up the butt and doing the 5 a.m. starts and just getting the word count down. And then redrafts. It managed to get done.
Yeah.
So that was lucky. But I wonder if I'd had other editors or a different publisher, I wonder if they'd have just gone, yeah, we'll leave it. But they had enough faith in me to go, no, we know you'll be back to yourself in a minute.
That's great, yeah.
Yeah. So that was very kind.
Yeah.
I think often people kind of go, oh, big publishers, oh, they don't care. They do. It's, you know, it's still back to people, and I've been so lucky with them. So I'm going to sing their praises a little bit. They were fantastic this year.
Cool. Yeah, it's good. And they do publish a lot of kind of. Well, actually, I did publish quite a bit from the Irish comedy scene. I know they published Maeve's book.
Yeah,
as well.
Maeve Higgins' book. Yeah. And I think they're quite supportive of women, really. You know, they've done some great stuff. So
yeah, great.
I'm a big fan of theirs.
Yeah, that's Hachette.
Marketing done.
I looked you up on IMDb.
Yeah.
Because you know, deep research.
Great! I'm so impressed.
The next thing, 2016. I hope this is true.
Go for it, tell me.
Zig and Zag?
Yes.
Really?
What?
Zig and Zag, the TV show.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
A whole new incarnation. It's an animated series for CBBC.
Right.
So there are quite a few Irish voices in it. Some of them, sometimes Irish accents, sometimes we're doing English accents, but for CBBC. And the aliens now live on a street in a town, and how do they cope with regular town life?
Oh my God.
Oh, it's for smallies, but it's absolutely brilliant and it looks great.
Is it aimed at kids, or is it aimed at people who were kids 20 years ago?
It's aimed at kids, but it is, I mean, it's still got all the zig and zag fun. It's so great. It looks gorgeous. I managed to see a completed episode there the other day. And
you're happy?
Oh, it's gorgeous. Wow. I mean, I don't have a massive part. I've got lots of small parts in it.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's of course, it's very Zig and Zag themselves heavy, which is all you want. Yeah. You hear those voices again, you see the Zogabongs, and you're just like, I'm happy. I'm so happy. Yeah.
Is Ray Darcy in it? Is he going to show up?
No, Ray's not in it. No. But I'm sure as soon as Ray starts doing voice character acting, he'll probably get the call.
That is, I suppose, a part of your bread and butter, is it? Or it was, anyway, the voice acting.
Oh, no, it is.
It is.
Voice work is still the main income, really. It's still something I do all the time, and I absolutely love it. So sometimes voiceovers for commercials and that sort of thing. But I did an animation last year, an animated feature called 2x2.
Okay.
Which got a release here and in the UK. It's being revoiced, of course, for the US US. But it was brilliant to work on.
Who did they get to do your voice in the US?
I don't know. I don't know her name, actually. I saw it. You check it on IMDb. You can check it, another IMDb check for you.
Okay.
So I played Hazel in the English language European version.
Okay.
So yeah, but so cool. It'll get revoiced, but it's getting a US release, which is fantastic because it's Motion Films in Galway. It's their baby, and so it's getting a US release.
Great.
So you can't, even if it's not my voice, I'm very proud that it's getting the US release. It's great.
Do you be like just driving along in your car and then hear your voice come on all the time?
And I still blush. Yeah.
Do you?
Because it's like no one likes their voice. It doesn't even matter if you do it for a job.
Yeah.
You hear your voice and go, oh God. Oh no.
So you're the voice, are you, of You Have No New Messages?
I was, it's because they've rebranded us three. They're moving away from it. I think they're maybe using a new voice or we're transitioning. Yeah. But yeah, that was O2 forever.
Give us it again, will you?
You have no new messages. To delete messages while listening, press 5.
That's amazing.
So there you go.
We had our previous episode, our most recent episode, is with Arthur Matthews.
Oh, great.
Who
obviously
wrote Toast of London.
That's right.
With the voiceovers.
I hear you, Clem Fandango.
You're so funny.
I actually got to work with Matt Berry on his Radio 4 show. I played Filthy Mermaid. Because he found out somewhere online, he found out that I had played the Caramel Bunny at one stage.
Oh really?
Yeah, really? Did you?
Yeah.
All right.
Just for one commercial, just for Ireland. I think it was Miriam Margulies is the Caramel Bunny. She's the long standing
Caramel Bunny.
But I did one for Ireland for an Irish TV commercial. Oh no, it was an Irish radio commercial, and I was the Caramel Bunny. And he found that out somewhere online and said, "Can you come in and do that? Like a bunny like voice, a kind of a caramelly kind of voice, but filthy." So swearing and, so it's that kind of voice, but lots of swears and filth. So and that's actually the character's name. Yeah. Filthy Mermaid.
So, amazing.
Yeah, it's good fun. That's his I Regress, his radio show. So,
I haven't listened to it. I must listen to it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's still available somewhere. Oh, he's got the best voice and he's so funny.
He's so funny. Do you spend a lot of your time in rooms like this, little kind of glass rooms?
The little glass room there, yeah, I do. I do. With headphones on me. Yeah. And
I've never done any voiceovering, but is it like that with the Clem Fandango in the behind the glass?
Sometimes. And, yeah. Sometimes you've got the clients in there and they're all saying, "Could you speed it up but make it sound slower?" No. But what you say is, "Yes, no problem."
Yeah. And you still improv? Do you still do?
Yeah, I haven't been able to get down lately because I've been, promoting the book and all over the place. But it's a spiritual
Monday
home
nights
for
at
me.
The,
Monday
the
nights at the International since 1992. Yeah. We're still there.
Yeah.
I haven't been there for that whole time, but I've been there since 1999.
Yeah.
So it's just fantastic fun. It's you get to make stuff up and hang out with your mates and be stupid, and that's my favorite thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and kind of all the big names are still there, still doing it, isn't it? The original
Dublin
Improv.
So Michelle Reid, Ian Coppinger, Joe Rooney, Paul Tylak, Dermot Whelan, we're all still there. Sharon Mannion and Danny Keough are there with us now. So and they had Phil Jupiter on there the other night.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, we all sort of played together. If we're in the UK or something, we'll all play together. We've played together in Australia and stuff. All the UK
Who's
lads
nice
and
anyway?
Us. Yeah. So. So when they're here, they play with us. So it's good crack.
It's great.
But not so much stand up.
No, not anymore. No, I don't think it was a great stand up. I did it because it was sort of assumed that, and particularly pre-internet, I think it was sort of assumed that if you had a comedy voice, it had to come out that way.
Yeah.
But I've found ways that suit my voice better now. I'm not a great joke one liner is bash 'em out over 20 minutes person. And I really admire people who find ways to subvert that stereotype I've just put out there of the 20 minutes of jokes. But I it's not something I really ever felt great at. And I thought, I'm going to leave it to the ones who are great at it and I'll find other ways to explore the funny.
Yeah, that's it's fair enough if you don't feel... I mean, there's lots of one-liners in here.
It's funny. They seem to come out. They seem to come out through the longer form, which is bizarre.
Yeah, that's just how it works sometimes. I mean, I'm the same with writing. It's just like you're writing about one thing, and then there's like a one liner, and you kind of feel, I have to put it in, because you still love it. You still love comedy,
Yeah, God. Oh, listen, I love comedy, and I'm in awe of amazing stand ups. I think whenever I see something great happening, I'm like,
who do you really like?
I love Tommy Tiernan. Yeah. I love that incredible storytelling. I really like Stuart Lee and I like how he plays with the form. Yeah. I love Alison Spittal at the moment.
Yeah, she's great.
I'm a huge fan of hers. Yeah. Eleanor Tiernan, brilliant.
Yeah.
Maria Bamford, huge fan of hers. Yeah, so there are loads and loads and loads. I'm always interested in seeing who's coming up and how they're changing things. I have no interest in the career comics, the people just standing there going, look at me, I'm great crack. If someone's doing something or trying something or bending the form a bit, I'm like, wow, that's so cool.
The people who want to get their solid 20 minutes and then get on television.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for instance, I saw Trevor Noah and I remember people saying, oh, they were talking about other comics on doing edgier stuff. And I thought, he's talking about racism. And it's great crack.
Yeah.
What he's doing isn't immediately apparent. He's sugarcoating something really dark and bouncing around the stage in a high energy way and talking about racism. And I just thought that was incredibly clever. So I'm really intrigued to see that he's got such a big job now and hosting a daily show.
Have you seen this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd love to see what's going to happen in a few months. I like to give people time to bed in.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Find their own way of doing things. So I'm banking them on the DVR. I've seen a couple, and I can't wait to see what he's doing in a few months because I think he's really exciting.
Okay.
And when I saw him, I thought he was really exciting. But some people kind of went, "Yeah, is it a bit tame?" And I went, "No, I don't think it's tame at all. I think he's fooling you.
He's tricking you.
Yeah, he's tricking you." So that's the kind of stuff I would find much more inventive than.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, edge, I'm Edgy Edgerson. I'm so edgy. No, you're not. No, you're not. Yeah. No, I heard it all before. And your setups are all pullback and reveals and snooze.
Yeah, yeah.
And sleep.
So boring. Yeah.
So
somebody was mean to me, and then I was like, oh, mom. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I got off the bus.
Yeah, yeah. He's playing Vicar Street soon, I think, isn't he?
I'm not sure. I don't have the events in my head.
Yeah, I think Trevor Noah is playing.
Oh, great, great. Yeah. I'll be there going, I love you tricking me. Thanks for tricking me.
Just about the racism thing, this is the last thing. And then
I'd love to talk for ages.
That's how you first kind of, is it the first kind of activism stuff you studied with the...
No, Case for Mammy Daddy Marriage was the first
one. Oh, was that first?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And then the Racist B&B came after.
Racist B&B came after. That was very, very personal.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. It can seem like I'm, going at lots of issues. I'm actually going at one, equality.
Yeah.
Anyone telling us that equality shouldn't be allowed or challenged or, attempting shushing, and racism is another shushing.
Yeah,
absolutely. My husband being called all kinds of names on the street. And for people who don't know, I say it's like this a lot, and I kind of feel like, are people going, oh, she's talking about the husband again? But it's actually just in case. I don't assume everyone knows the story. So my husband's African American. He got racist abuse on the street in my hometown, but it's not about the town. It's Kinsale in County Cork. It's such an incredibly welcoming, inclusive place.
Yeah.
So if it can happen there, it just was an eye opener for me. I was a bit naive, I suppose, thinking it wouldn't happen there. It couldn't. But if it's happening there, it's definitely happening everywhere.
Yeah.
So it was just a bit of an eye-opener for me. I also realised that because of the size of it, I got to hear about the racism my husband was experiencing, because when he's in Dublin, he has to travel a good bit further home. He's usually calmed himself down and he just doesn't tell me.
Yeah.
Whereas in Kinsale, he just came up the road and in the door and he was shaking.
Yeah.
He was absolutely shaking and he was sort of grey in the face, just totally, really pale.
Jeez.
And when you see the physical reaction, the physical response that a person's body has to discrimination, it's very hard not to say something. I wanted to go to the guards. He didn't. But there is a reporting site that the European Network Against Racism Ireland runs called ireport.ie. So even if you witness racism, you don't have to have experienced it directly. You can report it because they need a database of exactly what is going on.
Yeah, okay.
ireport.ie. You can go there. It's very user friendly. It's really simple. So let's say a friend of mine said to me, "God, I'm so glad I heard of that site. I saw someone giving someone abuse at a petrol station the other day." I said, that's exactly, you go and just say what you saw, because there's even something you can tick to say, were you the person who was being abused or were you a third party, were you a witness, and you can tick all that.
Yeah.
And then say, was it verbal abuse, physical abuse? They just need to know so we can get a really clear picture.
Okay.
Because sometimes people are too afraid to go to the guards, and then you don't, if it's not reported, you don't get the full picture of what's happening. Yeah. So iReport.ie is a brilliant idea. I've used it several times since I've heard about it. I've used it several times to say I witnessed this.
Yeah. I've never heard of it. That's actually a really good idea.
So it's just information gathering. If then they find they hear something is maybe in breach of the law, they might approach you and say, would you feel comfortable or do you need support going to the guards? Because some people are too afraid to go to the guards.
Yeah.
And they might help you then, you know, again, with your if you're up for it, they might ask you to report and they'll you know, talk you through that. But mostly it's just you won't hear from them. You just report it and say, I saw this happening.
Okay.
So I think that's a great one.
Cool. All right, well, that's good to know. We better let you go.
Oh, it was great chatting to you, though. Thanks for having me. I wish I could stay.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks so much. We'll get you on again.
Thank you so much. And I'll drink out of my Headstuff mug with pride.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So that was episode 19 with Tara Flynn. I hope you enjoyed that. Connor enjoyed it.
I did.
So that's over now. Thanks for listening to that. Just a quick round of thank yous to Connor from Wilkins Sound System. So thanks to Connor. Thanks to Video Blue for the theme tune, to Mikey for the artwork, the ADK Music Group in Westland Studios for letting us record here. Please do join the Facebook group called the Headstuff Podcast and rate us and subscribe and leave a comment on iTunes if you can. That'd be really good. Or follow us on SoundCloud if that's if that takes your fancy. Also, a massive thanks to Tara Flynn for coming in. Her book, Giving Out Yards, is out now in all of the bookshops. And I highly recommend picking it up and putting it in a stocking for Christmas. So thanks.
You're
allowed to read it before Christmas. But also at Christmas.
Okay.
And not at Christmas. So thanks for that. And we will talk to you next week. Goodbye.